This is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the Department of History. Today is November 5th, 2013, and I'm here in James Fastook's office to interview him about his experiences with the Climate Change Institute. All right, so just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you can tell me how you got attracted to glaciology.
Sure. I was a PhD in the physics department here at the university, and my field of study in physics was atmospheric physics. We had a big cloud chamber in the basement, and we could put various pollutants into the cloud chamber, and we were measuring how water droplets grew as a function of humidity and trace pollutant content. And I was under the impression that we were doing weather physics. I thought we were studying, you know, how releasing unburned hydrocarbons into the atmosphere was going to change the nature of the clouds. That's what I thought I was doing. But I met my advisor's advisor at a conference, and I asked my advisor's advisor what he was working on, you know, just idle conversation. I asked him, what are you working on? And he said, I can't tell you. And I said, what do you mean you can't tell me? We're doing cloud physics. And he says, I can't tell you. Think about it. Taking water drops and with trace pollutants and move them from a low humidity environment to a high humidity environment and know how they're going to grow. And what he was describing was chemical warfare, was the delivery of the maximum amount of pollutant, the poison, to the depths of the lungs. And if the drops didn't grow fast enough, they would stay small and you would inhale them and exhale them back out. If they grew too fast, they would be swept up by the cilli in your nose and you wouldn't get it into the lung. And so you had to design this water drop that would grow at just the right rate, so that it got into the deep penetrated part of the lung and was then big enough to impact the surface and stick there and deliver the toxin to the worst place. And so what I realized is that the work I was doing was weapon research, and I was not very happy with that. At the same time, I had one course to finish for my PhD, one class necessary to fulfill the requirement for the PhD. And I had a choice kind of, I'd taken everything in physics, and I had a choice between a numerical analysis class in the math department, you know, some kind of dry numerical method thing. But I'd seen a flyer for Terry Hughes's glaciology class, and in the flyer, he talked about using tensors. And I had just come from a relativity class and was full of tensors. They were, you know, I understood them. I liked them. I thought they were a cool device, you know, way beyond vectors as a cool mathematical construct. And so I signed up for Terry's glaciology class on a lark rather than the numerical analysis class that would have been a more traditional path. Well, Terry was in the earth sciences department, then geology. And so everyone in the class was a geologist, except me. I was a physicist. And Terry was very mathematical. He did a lot of equations. He put a lot of things up on the board. You know, he'd cover the board with equations and write things out and cancel terms and do all this stuff. The homework assignments, because I had just come from this relativity class where I'd learned a particularly powerful notation for manipulating tensors called the Einstein notation, I was able to do the homeworks that he assigned in three or four lines, whereas everybody else using a more primitive notation had to write out page after page after page of equations. But my notation was powerful enough that I didn't have to do all of that. I did have to write out two pages of how the notation worked, because I wasn't sure that Terry knew the Einstein notation. Since he didn't use it in class, I didn't know that he knew it. So my homeworks, instead of being 5 pages of equations, were 4 lines of equations and 2 pages of how the notation worked. And so I kind of impressed Terry. The other thing that got me involved with the Institute was that physics got one of the first desktop computers of the day. This was 77 or something like that. And it was a Hewlett Packard. It had a one-line screen. It was programmed in BASIC, and it was connected to an XY plotter. Well, at the time, Terry was doing the climap reconstruction of the Laurentide ice sheet. And in order to do this, you had to, because the models were relatively primitive then, you had to tune the model to the shape of the present ice sheets. So what Terry was doing was he was taking this deck of cards that was the program of his equations, and he was putting parameters for the equations on cards, and he was handing it over the desk at the computer center and waiting 2 hours for the printout to come back from the computer run. And the printout was a list of numbers, and he would take that list of numbers and he would graph it on graph paper by hand and see how well it fit the profile of the glacier. And if it was too high, he would change one number in the deck of cards. If it was too low, he'd change another number. and he would, you know, have to sit at a terminal and type it out on a card and stick it back in the deck and put it over the counter and wait 2 hours for it to come back, another list of numbers, graph it by hand again. And I had this machine that you could type the number into the computer and it would draw the picture on the XY plotter right then. And so I showed this to Terry. I had programmed his equations from class into this desktop computer. I could interactively interact with the program directly as opposed to cards over the counter, wait 2 hours, results come back as numbers. I could type the number into the computer and it drew the picture right away. And so I was very powerful mathematically, Terry liked that. And two, I had access to these computers that made the mainframe seem like a virtual antique, interactive computing. And so Terry offered me a job right then, and while the class was still going on. He said, as soon as you graduate, come work for me. And so I did, you know, and I was happy to go from atmospheric, from cloud physics that I thought was weather, but turned out to be chemical warfare, to glaciology, where, to my knowledge, no one has ever weaponized the glacier. There's no weapon applications for glaciers. And so I came and worked for Terry. I did the tuning for the Climap book. The Denton and Hughes Last Great Ice Sheets book has all the reconstructions in it. And I did the reconstructions for that. And I did it in a matter of weeks, where Terry, with his card system, it would have taken him months or even years to do the same thing. Because I could do it in 3 seconds, what took him 2 hours to do.
So that book is in glaciology regarded as a fairly important work, I take it.
Yeah, it's old, but at the time, George Denton is a very broad thinker, and he kind of went through all the literature on where all the ice sheet margins were known to be in the world, and he and Terry drew maps of the outlines of the ice sheets. Mm-hmm. And the Climap project, what the intent of it was to provide boundary conditions for some climate modelers who were doing models of the ice age world climate. Anytime you're a modeler, one thing you want to do is model more than one situation. Because if you model one situation, your parameters that you've used to tune it, to get it to fit that one situation, may not be broadly applicable to another system, another world. And so these people, the climate people, had done fairly successful models of the current climate. You know, their weather predicting devices predicted when it was going to rain, where it was going to rain. They had good forecasting ability, but they didn't know if it would work for a different world. And they chose the Ice Age world because, A, it's very different from the present world, much, much colder, you know, snow and ice everywhere. And B, it's fairly close to the present in time. It's not 65 million years ago, it's 14,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago. It's fairly recent in geologic time. And because it's fairly recent in geologic time, there's a lot of evidence of what the climate was like then. There are climate proxies in the forms of, you know, beetles and pollen and bog records. And so it was a world that they had access to information about. But one of the pieces of information they didn't have was what the topography of the planet was, because with ice sheets are big. They're like mountain ranges that are not there now. So during the Ice Age, there was a mountain range over what's now Hudson Bay. And so the climate, the circulation of the air was much, much different. It flowed down around the south edge of this thing and up around the north side of it. It couldn't flow straight across it the way it can now. And so they were interested in having a topography of this Ice Age world. They wanted to know the height of the glacier because it affected their climate models, how the air flowed across the planet. And the glacial geologists at the time knew pretty well what the footprint of the glacier was. You know, they've got moraines, piles of dirt that they've been able to date with carbon-14, that they know this pile of dirt was built at a certain time. And they've traced these piles of dirt around the periphery of the ice sheets. And so they know what the footprint is, but they didn't know what the elevation was. And the only way to get at the elevation was with a model. And so the paradigm that we took was we had a set of equations that described how ice deforms. And what we didn't know was how hard the ice was, how much it deforms for a given force. So we took this set of equations, programmed it to make profiles through slices through a glacier, and we compared those profiles with the two existing ice sheets that we have, Greenland and Antarctica. And with this comparison, we were able to tune in what the ice hardness of the current ice sheets was. And then we made the assumption that the paleo ice sheets had the same ice hardness. So we took and programmed slices through this ice sheet. We knew where the edges were. We just didn't know how big it was in the middle. And so we could then predict how big the ice sheets had been. And we provided that as input data for these GCMs that were running as part of the CLIMAP problem. And I forget what CLIMAP stands for. It's some acronym. It's all capital letters.
Mm-hmm. So when Terry Hughes hired you, it was what, as a technician?
As a postdoc. I was
a postdoc.
And it was originally for 2 years, and it involved a trip to Antarctica. We went down to Antarctica and measured the velocity of the Berg Glacier. We laid out targets for a photogrammetry flight that came over and took pictures and then came back and took pictures 3 months later. And we were able to compare the photos and see how much the ice had moved in that time. And from that, we got the velocity of this ice. Now they do it, you know, remotely with a satellite. But in that time, velocities were mostly measured by putting stakes in the ice and surveying in their position and then coming back 3 months later and surveying the stake to see how much it had moved. And it was very labor intensive, and this photogrammetry was like kind of revolutionary because it gave us hundreds and hundreds of velocity measurements from the photographs as opposed to from people crawling around on the surface of the ice risking their lives to falling crevasses. It was all done from airplanes, so that was a bigger deal. we still had to put in the control for the photographs. We had to survey in the mountain peaks, the rock outcrops that were stationary. We had to know where they were so that when they referenced some moving target, a crevasse or a serac or something that could be seen in the photos, when they moved, we'd know how much they'd moved relative to something that was fixed. Mm-hmm. And so we basically surveyed mountaintops and other things that stuck up through the ice.
I see.
And I was there for one season. I didn't like it a whole lot. I'm not a real good field person.
One season,
yeah. Okay. Terry went a lot. He went, I think, three or four seasons.
Mm. So a few months you were there.
Yeah, I was there from middle of October until middle of January, I guess.
Can you walk me through a typical day in Antarctica?
A typical day in Antarctica?
Sure.
You should really talk to Brenda Hall about typical days in Antarctica, since she still goes there. I went once and didn't like it a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, a typical day for you when you were there.
A typical day for me?
Yeah.
Well, we were in field camps. We were living in tents, Scott tents, which are about 6.5 feet square, and you can stand up in the center of them. They're a pyramid type tent, and they're the kind of tents that they've been using since the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. You know, Scott and Amundsen and all those guys use these kind of tents. I don't know why. They're stable in the wind, I think. But we were living, the surveying teams were two people. I was with a guy named Tad Pfeffer, who's still a friend. He's out in Colorado. And we were assigned a survey spot, a top of a cliff that we could see the whole glacier out in front of us. And we had a theodolite set up on the top of the cliff. And every day, Terry, who was the PI of the project, would arrive in the helicopter. And the helicopter would fly out into the glacier, and we'd track it in the theodolite. And they'd land somewhere on the glacier and lay out a target. And we would measure the angles to that target out on the glacier and reference them to some other target on the ice. And so we did this the whole way around the edge of the glacier so that we had targets all around the edge and a line of targets up the middle that were these big Mylar crosses that we had to put out. And the big Mylar crosses were going to show up in the photograph. They were going to be reference things. We had early versions of GPS, the GPS that you've got in your phone or whatever that measures position with the satellites. We had an early version of that. It was about the size of a beer cooler, and it took 3 or 4 days to figure out where it was. Mm. And only it didn't figure it out in real time. It recorded its information on tape. And you took that back to the lab in the United States and with a supercomputer processed that into a position for this object with time. So we had these beer cooler things that were GPS units that we had to put out on these moving targets that we would measure where they were as they moved down the ice. So Tad and I spent most of our time in this tent. We moved along the edge of the glacier, Terry flying in the helicopter overhead, putting out targets. The Mylar targets had to be weighted down with rocks. And so every day or so, Terry would arrive in the big Huey helicopter, and Tad and I would spend the afternoon loading rocks into the helicopter, which Terry would then fly away with to deposit on the glacier.
Yeah.
To hold down the Mylar.
Mm-hmm. Terry himself wasn't flying the...
No, he was a passenger.
I see.
No, there were Navy pilots from... The Navy did the support in those days, and so there were Navy pilots who were flying us around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were Huey-type, Vietnam-era-type helicopters.
Mm-hmm. When you were out there, did you or somebody you were working with have any close calls where we almost got hurt?
Well, no one got hurt really seriously, but we did have a helicopter mishap. A helicopter that took off from a Nunatak mountain that sticks up through the ice. And we had just dropped a team of surveyors off on the Nunatak and were flying across to another place to drop off Tad and I. Terry, Tad, and I were in the helicopter. We had dropped off Mark Hyland and I can't remember the other guy's name. It was a gray day. You know, the sky was gray instead of blue. And when that happens in Antarctica, it's sometimes hard to see where the horizon is because, you know, the gray snow turns into the gray sky. And I think the pilot was probably watching his radar altimeter instead of out the window. And the radar penetrated the snow and so was giving him a false sense of elevation, and he basically flew it into the ground. And so the helicopter, you know, hit and rolled and came apart. And we thought Tad was hurt badly. He wasn't in the long run, but we thought at the time that his back was hurt. And so, you know, we got him out and put a tent up over him, and we got the radio out and called for help, and, you know, a rescue mission came and picked us up and took us back to McMurdo. And that was, and that doesn't happen very often. The helicopter pilots were really, really good. They were all these, this was the 70s, and so the Vietnam War was just winding up, and there were a lot of pilots who had thousands and thousands of hours flying under really bad circumstances, you know, like with people shooting at them and helicopters breaking down because bullets had gone through the engines and stuff like that. So these guys were really good. But this guy just made a mistake and wasn't watching out the window. He was watching the altimeter instead.
You thought Tad was severely injured.
Yeah. We thought he had broken his back and treated it for that. We, you know, immobilized him and didn't, you know, apart from dragging him away from the helicopter, didn't move him. And when the rescue people came, they wired him up in a proper stretcher and, you know, took good care of him. It turned out not to be a broken back. It was a cracked vertebrae, but, you know, he was hurt. I was pretty much unscathed. Terry didn't have a scratch on him.
But the three of you were in the helicopter and it was tumbling around.
Yeah. The crewman had a broken rib and one of the pilots had a big cut on his forehead that made a lot of blood but wasn't serious. I really lost my interest in helicopters, though, at this point in time.
Yes.
I have to say.
I imagine you did.
Yeah.
Wow. So, when you and Tad, you basically, it was just you two, you had to share a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what, you got up in the morning, did you have some kind of a stove to cook food on?
Yeah, we had a regular camp stove, one burner camp stove. We made tea and oatmeal, and we had, the food was pretty good because it was well below freezing, so we had boxes and boxes full of frozen food, you know, frozen steak, frozen lobster, frozen vegetables, frozen, you know, it was like having a walk-in refrigerator outside the tent in this wooden box. And we were not lightweight. We had 1,000 pounds of gear. We were not hikers. It was, we had generators. We had solar panels. We had two tents, you know, the tent we lived in and an emergency tent in case we burned down the tent that we lived in. Mm-hmm. We had sleeping bags that were huge, these great down bags that, you know, you could barely get them in a full-size duffel bag.
Mm.
And they were all feathers, you know, no synthetics. We had, you know, we had crampons and stuff like that for negotiating rough terrain, but we never did because it was too scary.
And you had cot in your tent?
Yeah, we had cot. Yeah.
You had a separate tent for preparing food? Or?
No, we cooked and lived in the Scott tent. Now, sometimes we would cluster up together into a larger camp with multiple tents, in which case we would have a sleeping tent and a food tent. But we didn't cluster up that much. We were mostly in teams of two in a single Scott tent.
Prior to going to Antarctica, had you read any of the accounts of the early Antarctic explorers?
No.
Were you interested in doing so afterwards?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you?
I have, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. When you were out there, did you see yourself as a kind of explorer?
Of course. And we were actually one of the guys on our team was an actual heroic era explorer, a guy named George Swithin. I can't remember his first name. Swithinbank was his last name. He's still around. Terry communicates with him. He's an English guy, and he was, there in the 40s as one of the heroic age explorers before IGY in 59, which was when the first real expeditions went to Antarctica with, lots of money. He was there in the 40s as an explorer. And because he was from this era, he was always prepared to walk out. Like, we couldn't have walked out. If the helicopters couldn't pick us up, we were going to die where we were. But he was ready to walk out. He had all the survival gear and a sled and crampons and snowshoes and whatever he needed to walk out if he had to. If the helicopters didn't pick him up, he would have trekked the 150 miles to McMurdo and gotten out alive, because he was of that era where you had to be prepared for that. We were the younger scientists who were, dependent on helicopters.
Yeah. The heroic age of exploration, what was the rough chronology of that?
Oh, well, around the turn of the century, around World War I is kind of when it starts.
Up to about the 1940s.
It's pretty much from turn of the century. I mean, the guy, Scott, who goes to the pole and didn't make it in time because Amundsen beat him there, and Shackleton and Perry and all these guys who were, well, Perry's kind of later, but all these guys who went there first, first to the pole and stuff like that. That's the beginning of the heroic age, and it ends kind of in 1959 with the International Geophysical Year, which was actually 2 years, but but that's when the first real scientific expeditions go to Antarctica, and they perform a lot of mapping, and a lot of real science expeditions begin in 1959. Before that, it was just guys wandering around making maps, but the science starts in the late 50s.
And I understand Hal Borns was one of the early...
I think both Hal and George Denton were there in IGY.
Mm-hmm.
George Denton was a graduate student there at the time, I think. I think you'd have to check with him, but I think he was there in IGY. And Hal definitely was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, at what point did you become a faculty member?
I was a postdoc for something like 7 years, a really long postdoc. Most postdocs are 2 years, but I liked it. And so, when the CLIMAP grant was over, I wrote a grant of my own and got funding and was doing that for, I think, 7 years. I'd have to check my records, but I was on soft money, external funded money, for that entire time period. Then the money dried up. partly because the Antarctic Treaty was renegotiated. Like prior to this, the NSF had a dedicated line to Antarctic research, and consequently, they had a certain amount of money they had to spend in Antarctica, and it made getting funding kind of easy, because if you were willing to go and you were willing to work in Antarctica, there was money to do it. The feds wanted to spend money in Antarctica, partly because when the treaty came up for renegotiation, the countries that had spent the most money would be able to say, look, we've spent a lot of money here. We want a big part in writing the new treaty. And the new treaty came up in, I think, 79 or something like that. No, 83 or something like that. And when they renegotiated, NSF lost its line, a dedicated line. And the program then had to compete for money just like all the other directorates of the NSF. And it got significantly harder to get funding. And I ran out of money. And I was contract teaching here at the university. I had a job in the math department. I taught in physics, teaching for people who were on sabbatical, an adjunct. And I was doing this in computer science, and the guy for whom I was covering didn't come back from his sabbatical. It was one of the .com run-ups, and he found a better job while he was on sabbatical, and he didn't come back, and I slipped into his job, which is how I ended up in computer science.
Okay. At what point did you become a member of the Quaternary Institute?
When I was a postdoc, so it would have been, 78.
Yeah, you joined almost right away then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My postdoc was in the institute.
Mm-hmm.
I was a member of the institute from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I'm a cooperating member now, only because my whole salary line is in computer science. I have no salary in the institute.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the faculty over there have joint appointments,
mm-hmm.
which means that they get money from both departments. But I get all my academic salary from computer science, so I'm a cooperating member.
Mm-hmm.
But I have, same voting rights and committee responsibilities as everybody else.
Right. So, when it was still the Quaternary Institute, did you participate in any research with other members besides Terry and George?
The Kelloggs. I wrote a paper with the Kelloggs at one point. Hal. I've had a number of collaborations with Hal.
Can you give me a? Could you give me a specific example of a project you did with Hal?
We're looking at the Younger Dryas re-advance of the Loch Lomond ice sheet in Scotland. And so I was doing reconstructions of what the ice sheet would do. Hal was mapping the margins, and I was figuring out how much the climate would have to change in order to make the glacier grow from nothing, which it pretty much went away during the period before the Younger Dryas re-advance. And it grew out to this position, and how much the climate had to change in order for the glacier to grow that much was the kind of project that I did with Hal.
Walk me through sort of the human side of a collaboration of that nature. Did Hal approach you and say, James, I'm thinking about doing this. Do you want to work together on it?
Oh, gosh. I have no recollection of how that happened. I mean, we have regular meetings in the institute. Every month at 7:30 on Wednesday morning, we meet for a couple hours, and the director talks to us, and then afterwards there's coffee and donuts. No donuts anymore, but still coffee. Mm. And conversations occur at those kind of meetings. We've at various times in the past had relatively active speaker series where, you know, on a Wednesday night we'd meet in a classroom building and somebody would give a talk, not necessarily from the Institute, but somebody from away that we'd bring in. And so there were those opportunities for conversation. We have a regular field trip that we go on every fall when where we are locked up in a bus as we drive across the landscape looking at sand pits and moraines and archaeological sites and historical landmarks. And sometimes we go as far as Cape Cod and, or Quebec, or they took a field trip to Newfoundland a couple years ago. And so you're locked in a traveling vehicle with the gang for that much time, and mm-hmm. you end up a lot of chance to talk. We have an annual seminar series, a two-day mini conference where everyone in the Institute is expected to give a conference style talk on what they're doing at the time, including the graduate students and the faculty. Mm-hmm. And the Institute's gotten a little big for a two-day session now. We really need a 3 or 4 day session in order for everyone to have 15 minutes. But when the Institute was smaller, everybody would give a talk on what they were doing, and then there's lunch and a meal, and plenty of time to talk between sessions, and so there's plenty of opportunity for collegiate conversation. And at least in the Glacier side of things, most of us knew what we were doing and how it could be useful to our research. So, I've always served the geologists. Modeling by itself is not that interesting, but modeling in support of somebody collecting data is. And the geologists are collecting data. And one of the things that modeling can do is provide kind of a way of looking at the field evidence that they're seeing and help them to interpret it. It allows you to kind of interpolate between data points, and that, you know, if the boundary was here and here, then it had to be here in between. So you didn't have to measure the whole boundary. You could measure points on the boundary, and the model would interpolate physically in between. Because climate is one of our concerns, that how much the climate has to change in order to make the glacier do what the geologists think it did is a way of kind of measuring the climate in the past.
How do you think the Institute has changed since you first got involved with it?
One of the biggest changes is I no longer have to explain what it's for. When it was the Quaternary Institute, people would say, "What's that?" And I would say that, you know, that's the current geologic epoch. It's the last 2.5 million years. It's what went on in that epoch is mainly the coming and going of the glaciers. We study the glaciers, and we're trying to figure out why glaciers come and go. That was, you know, the research question. But as we changed our focus from just studying the Quaternary, that geologic time period, to kind of a broader evaluation of climate change. And this occurred when Paul joined the Institute. Paul brought this climate change emphasis to the Institute, and it gave us a focus to our research that was much more societal impact oriented, and not so much just for the abstract knowledge of why ice ages occur, and you know, why did the ice go away, and where did it come from to begin with, and will it come again, and you know, those kind of academic science questions, to actually being able to predict climate change in the future and understand what the consequences of it will be. And, you know, even back in the Climap days, what those people were trying to do was kind of validate their climate models, figure out, you know, they work great for now, but how will they work when the system changes? In other words, when CO2 loading occurs. Because they were making these predictions about climate warming back then. I mean, the original greenhouse effect was a back of the envelope calculation done in, I don't know, 18 something. It's basic elementary thermodynamics, that if you trap more solar radiation than you reflect, it gets warmer inside, and it's a simple equation that measures it, or that describes it. But the climate models of the day were beginning to have these kind of predictions, and nobody would believe them because they said, oh, your model's tuned for the present. It's not appropriate for this changed world that you're describing. And so they were looking for changed worlds to do models of, to confirm that their models work, that you could actually have less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and a mountain range here that's no longer there and the ocean's colder, and that it would predict weather that was appropriate to what was measured on land by the pollen proxy and the beetle proxy and all these other temperature precipitation measurements that they were making. Mm-hmm. And that was why they were doing it. That's why we were providing them with information. But at the time, it was not couched in terms of climate change so much as understanding climate. And as climate change became a confirmed occurrence, of course, now we're looking at rates of change and looking for analogs in the past when the climate changed as rapidly, or you know, maybe almost as rapidly as it's changing now, so that we can understand how the landscape changed then from evidence, and that'll inform our predictions of how the landscape will change in the future as things change. It's been warmer in the past than it is now, but it didn't get that warm that fast. It got warm gradually and it cooled off again. The medieval warmth period is a time that was warmer than now, but it didn't warm up like the hockey stick. It warmed up gradually and it cooled off gradually. And that's kind of natural climate change. And what we're doing is we're ramping it up. We're changing it faster than it has in the past. Mm-hmm. But the consequences will be the same. You know, I mean, it's just that from the animal's point of view, they don't have as much time to adapt to it. You know, when it warmed up the last time, the polar bears had a chance to move someplace else and find some other way to catch seals. But you know, now in the lifespan of one polar bear, it's gone from, you know, a place they can eat to a place they can't.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the Institute's most important contribution to climate science has been?
We have a lot of outreach right now. We have a lot of our students are not so interested in process as they are in policy. We have a lot of students who want to become informed climate scientists so that they can affect policy, because whether they affect policy as climate scientists or whether they run for Congress, one of the ways that the old paradigm gets swept aside is that the old people who hold that paradigm die and are replaced by young people who have a new paradigm. And so it would be really sweet to see a number of our climate change graduates who understand climate and are aware of the realities of the situation in positions of decision-making within government and other agencies that have to do something, or things are going to get rather strange. Things may already be going to get kind of strange, but we have a lot of students who are interested in it, not so much from, you know, doing the science as from the policy point of view. And they came up with this themselves. We had the students themselves actually formed a group of, you know, this was 3 or 4 years ago, but they formed a group to study climate policy. And, you know, they asked for a course in climate policy. And I think, I'm not sure who teaches that. It might be Kirk, but, you know.
Outside the scientific community, the human role in climate change still is very much up for debate.
No, it's debated. It's not up for debate.
Yes, it's debated. I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
One very simple answer is that the companies that own the carbon would like to sell it, and they would really rather not have restrictions put on them selling the carbon that they have in the ground. You know, the oil companies who have big reserves of oil, they would like to be able to sell it. The Canadians who have all the tar sands, they would like to be able to sell it. Canada just pulled out of the Kyoto Accords. Because since they signed the Kyoto Accords, they found all this tar sand and they became one of the big petroleum reservoirs of the planet. And it's partially a technology that they can extract petroleum from the tar sands. It's also a price of oil that, you know, reached some particular level where it became economically feasible to take petroleum out of tar sands. But Canada has become one of the oil oligarchs that, you know, they've got as much oil as Saudi Arabia. Don't quote me on that. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but they got a lot of oil and they've pulled out of the Kyoto Accords. Because, you know, if you've got a lot of carbon, you'd like to be able to sell it. It's a money. And, you know, I mean, I the deniers, they're not always, they're sometimes encouraged by interests. I mean, I don't know how much of this I want to say on a recording in terms of specific names, but there are people who are funding climate deniers.
Such as large oil corporations?
Indirectly, I suppose, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
You know, I came to the university as a graduate student in 1971, did a PhD here, had a postdoc that I still look back on as, you know, the best years of my career. I had no teaching obligations. I had no meeting obligations. It was just 7 years of purely doing science. I have a really good teaching gig here. Working in the computer science department is a lot of fun. They give me a lot of resources. I'm surrounded by more computers than I can use. I'm given a lot of time to study new things. Part of my job assignment is learn something new. I'm not locked into doing the same thing over and over and over again. I'm encouraged to branch out into new things. A lot of my success as a scientist, I owe to the Institute, to the people who, the mentors in the department, Hal Borns and Terry Hughes and George Denton George Jacobson, and the mentors who encouraged a young scientist to go to meetings. Terry would come in and say, well, I submitted an abstract for you at this meeting. You've got 3 months until the meeting. Go write the paper. And he'd have already submitted the abstract for the paper that I was supposed to write. I hadn't written it yet, but he'd submitted the abstract. He provided me with money. He sent me places. I went to Holland and England and Sweden, Belgium, Switzerland. I've been to, and all on travel money from the Institute or from a funded grant that I got through the Institute. I really owe my career to the organization and the source of inspiration and the whole Institute. I'm very happy with my association with the Institute. Have been all along. Been great.
Okay. Well, thank you once again for agreeing to do this interview.
Okay.
Go ahead and stop the recording.